بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, depending on where in the country you're joining us from. Welcome to the live webinar on linking scenario planning and decision making by Dr. Alexander Vandeputay. It is a web-based online session arranged by Medina Institute of Leadership and Entrepreneurship. We are glad you could join us today. I am Ali Jafri, representing Mile, and will be moderating this webinar. I am going to give you a quick overview of Mile and the speaker and also walk through some of the housekeeping items. Then I'll turn it over to our featured presenter, Dr. Alexander Vandeputay, who will start the presentation. We are webcasting today from Belgium and Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. A brief introduction about Mile. The Medina Institute of Leadership and Entrepreneurship brings senior executives and high-potential leaders from all over the world to discover new dimensions in leadership and management practices and help them grow in their business careers. We offer participants in our programs priceless engagements with the world's most influential academic and business leaders on a range of critical management and leadership issues. We empower them with the desired leadership skills to help successfully transform their organizations and reach their personal goals. We are thankful to Dr. Alexander Vandeputay, who has given us some time and will be presenting his views shortly. You will also be able to download a copy of his presentation in PDF or PowerPoint format through our blog later post a webinar. We would request that you please hold your questions until the end of this presentation. Now, a quick word about the speaker. Dr. Alexander Vandeputay is a professor of strategic foresight at IE Business School, a senior director and a head of scenario processes and applications at PFC Energy International, the co-director of the executive master in oil and gas leadership at the Graduate Institute of International and Development Studies. He's the chairman of the academic board of the Caspian Development Center and an associate with the U.S. National Intelligence Council. Previously, Dr. Alexander was Senior Director and Head of Global Practices, Scenario Planning, Global Risks, and Competitiveness with the World Economic Forum, the Senior Strategy and Portfolio Advisor to the Committee of Managing Directors at Shell, a Director at PricewaterhouseCoopers, and an Engagement Manager at McKinsey. He has been a lecturer in an executive education at INSEAD, both France and Singapore, IMD and Wharton, and has taught at the Solovey School of Management, Boston University, and company programs at DuPont, Caterpillar, GE, Nuon, Shell, the Kazakhstan Development Bank, the Pew Center on Global Climate Change, and SETOA. Dr. Alexander is an economist and engineer by training. He holds advanced degrees in management and decision sciences from Boston University, was a BAEF fellow at Harvard University, holds a PhD in Management Strategy and Finance from the University of London, a doctorate in International Relations from the Geneva School of Diplomacy, and is finalizing a PhD in Engineering at Cambridge University. A quick brief housekeeping items. If you're having trouble with the webinar software, please log out and log in again. If somehow you get kicked off at any time, just reconnect using the instructions sent to you via email. With that, I'll go ahead and turn it over to Dr. Alexander. For that, you have to bear with us for just 1 minute. I have to make him a presenter. He has already joined us. Dr. Alexander, can you hear us?
I can hear you very well, Ali. Thank you
Maybe
very much.
We need
for
to
the
ask the audience. Audience, if you all can hear him, please type yes in the chat box. Okay, I've started receiving yes, 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 yes. So it sounds all good. The doctor, it's all in your hands, and you can formally proceed with your presentation.
Wonderful. Thank you indeed, Ali. Can you also see my screen? Can you see my screen, Ali?
Yes, we can indeed. It's currently reading Scenario Planning Decision Making, IE Business School. I think it's first slide.
Fantastic. Thank you indeed. Well, assalamu alaikum. Good evening. It's a real pleasure to be here for this webinar, which is called Scenario Planning and Decision Making. I don't know how many of you have experience with scenario planning and decision making, but I will assume that most of you may not necessarily be familiar with the topic. So let me start with a very short version, a bridged version, of a quote made by Alexander Kerncross. A trend is a trend until it bends. The version he published is much longer. But in essence, why do I put it up here? I put it up here because many people tend to focus on trends. And while trends are important, what very often takes them off guard is actually the discontinuities. And what I'm continuously looking for is, or trying to look for, is actually to spot the discontinuities. And that brings me actually to another quote, and that comes from an anthropologist, Mr. Charles Darwin, from Cambridge University. And he mentioned that it's not the strongest of species who survive, nor the most intelligent, but the ones most responsive to change. And in essence, one can say if this applies to species, and there are millions of species on planet Earth, this must also apply to companies and organizations, especially when they operate in an environment that is full of surprises and discontinuities. On the next slide, I want to show you a number of events that you will all recognize. Things like that apartheid would end in South Africa, that the oil prices would collapse in 1986, that the Cold War would end. But also more recently, and things that has affected us actually all, wherever we are in the world, that in 2008 that we would experience the worst global economic and financial crisis since the Great Depression. But also more recently, and especially here, living in Europe, we see this all around us, is actually that the Eurozone would experience an unparalleled debt crisis in this year and actually going forward as well. It's easy to say with hindsight, but I can show examples, not necessarily developed only by me, but by other scenario planners that actually have anticipated these discontinuities from occurring much before they actually happened. And one thing is that although it's not possible to predict the future, we can actually explore the future. And really I want to focus on the term exploration. We want to explore, we want to anticipate versus predicting, and we would do that using a process of scenario planning. Scenario planning is, however, not a means to an end, or is a means to an end. It's not strategy, as some people would think it is. It is a means to an end. It's designed to do something, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. Here you see a graph that some of you may have seen. We published it in the California Management Review, and it starts. It's a scenario planning and decision-making process, and it starts with what I would call exploring the contextual environment, or basically the micro-environment. Some people, Albert Bresson, who is now at Columbia University, he would call these jet streams. These are forces that are very high level, 30, 40,000 feet, but yet these forces influence not only the world, but also different countries, and also these forces shape industries and, as a result, the environment in which business operate. Within that context, we can come much closer down to Earth. Let's call those weather maps or focus scenarios. These could be at the country level. These could be at a specific industry level. They could explore a particular issue, but they become much more specific. And within those, companies then can actually formulate strategic options. And an option is the right but not the obligation. It's nothing more. But it is strategic in nature. That basically means that it could potentially turn into a decision. And then it becomes strategy. But one of the nice things about scenario planning is that we don't have to make necessarily decisions right now. And as a result, we need to monitor indicators, signals and signposts. I call them typically leading indicators. And then based on how these factors unfold, make decisions appropriately. Companies that have done this have systematically created competitive advantage over time. And I would say that the world is not necessarily more uncertain today than it is 10 or 20 years ago. Information that we have makes it seem that way, because we have access to the internet, we have access to the media, and the media is global, and information comes to us very quickly. And some people, as a result, perceive it more uncertain. But what remains important is actually to understand how these factors could unfold and how it could affect us in our personal lives, but also as a business field. After all, Mile is a business school at IE where I teach. I teach a course on scenario planning, but I don't necessarily only focus on scenario planning. I really focus on, well, what do we do with this? How do we turn it into actionable foresight and decisions? And this is what this process is all about. With the next two slides, I want to highlight that forecasting is potentially dangerous and that mental models influence forecast. We all have mental models, and our mental models come from our background, where we grew up, our education, our experiences. And there's nothing about a wrong or a bad mental model. It's basically that we hold different views of the world or of a different issue. But the risk is that we make extrapolations of our own mental models. When I start a scenario planning exercise, I listen more than I speak, because I want to understand what other people think and why they think as such, because I can learn from that. It would broaden my perspectives, and I will let them challenge my own mental models. But the risk is, if we rely too much on a given mental model, that it will influence forecast. This slide, you see 7 forecasts. The first one was made in 1981, and the last one was made in 1995. And in each case, the participants of the International Energy Workshop at Shell were asked to provide their forward-looking view of the oil price. And despite the fact that these are experienced planners, what I found interesting is that there are two things that we can observe for each and every forward-looking view. The oil price always went up from the timing that the forecast was made. And number two is that the trend line is the historical trend line. And what does this tell us? Actually, it tells us that human beings, like you and me, we tend to make linear extrapolations from the past, but also we very much look around us and what we observe around us today. And we don't tend to think into discontinuities. And hopefully after this webinar, you will think more about discontinuities. And also when we teach this as part of PALM, we will explore actually more discontinuities than actually trend lines. Another one was about 3 countries and gross domestic product, GDP, in PPP terms, purchasing power parity terms, and was developed by the IMF. And it's difficult to argue that the IMF does not have good economists. And in 1980, the numbers you see here are the actual numbers, and there's little dispute about the actual numbers in terms of US dollars billion for GDP in PPP terms for these three countries. And they were asked to provide a prediction, a forecast for these three countries in 2005. And this was their estimate or their forecast. And this is reality. Now, what is surprising is not just Russia and China, but even the United States. In 1980, the United States was already a developed country. And for a developed country, to predict economic growth is typically easier than for an emerging market. The band, the variance around the mean is typically less wide. But still, they were significantly wrong. And again, it has to do with the here and now. Very often it's the case, and this was no different. In 1980, mortgage prices, for example, in the United States, mortgage rates were in the range of 16 to 17%. These days, and very quickly after 1986, these mortgage rates went down. And as a result, GDP, in terms of purchasing power parity, grew much faster because people could, of course, afford housing, but also other things, much more than under high mortgage rates. But also, the perception was that the exchange rate between the US dollar and the yen would not fundamentally change. And at the time, it was not China, but it was Japan who was the main trading partner of the United States. And we had to wait until 1985 in order to see the Plaza Accord that would fundamentally change the exchange rate, which was before undervalued in the favor of the Japanese yen. If you look at Russia and China, the stories are very different. Economies typically did not anticipate that Russia's economy would actually contract. The actual of 2005 is, in essence, lower than the 1980 absolute figure. And then China, the big growth miracle of China, people did not anticipate that either. Dramatic change and a dramatic underestimation of the China's growth miracle. In order to arrive at a much more accurate view, what is clear is that we need to think in terms of discontinuities. And this is where scenario planning actually helps in order to do that well. So the question is then, what is scenario planning? And this is a definition that I like to use. In this particular case, there are only two scenarios. It could be that there are more than two scenarios. Some companies prefer to develop three. My suggestion would be never to develop more than two, than three, because otherwise it becomes very difficult to keep or tell a sufficiently different story about the different scenarios. The gray lines, the upper and the lower plausibility boundary, I would call those actually the cone of uncertainty. And for good scenarios, the scenarios need to plot within the cone of uncertainty. Otherwise, they would not be plausible anymore. And that's a key criteria of scenario planning. They also need to be alternative, so at least two, but potentially three. And they need to be divergent. If they're not divergent, then it won't challenge the strategist's mental models. And as a result, they won't come up with innovative ideas, innovative strategic options within the context of the way that different worlds could play out. The most difficult thing in scenario planning is, however, the fourth characteristics. And that is internally consistent. The logics of the scenarios need to be internally consistent over time. So the question is, can we do this? Well, my view is we can. Some companies have done it for more than 40 years, especially in the energy sector, but not just in the energy sector. And in order to do that, we need to use a step-by-step deductive process. There are two parts here. I will only focus on the first part. The second part I will keep for the end. And the first part has to do with scenario development. The reason why to use a deductive process is that we look at a complex puzzle, that we break it in different pieces, and that each of these pieces we can get a hold of, and as a result we can much easier address and solve that part of the puzzle, and then afterwards we put the puzzle back together into a coherent set of scenarios. It all starts with the central question. And the central question is in essence the kind of the reason why we do scenarios, which also means that scenarios are never off the shelf. Scenarios have to be tailor-made for the specific needs of a company, a country, or an organization, or a group of stakeholders. But also when we define the central question, we need to look at the time frame. The time frame is very important, but it's not necessarily that difficult to identify. I mentioned before, a trend is a trend until it bends. Well, certain trends do not bend if the time frame is taken too shortly. So we need to take a time frame under which that we can actually explore sufficient divergent views of the future. And the second step then is to identify the issues. I didn't come up with the term issue identification. Issues very often have a negative connotation. Maybe we want to call this the identification of different factors. Factors that could shape the question as posed in the central question and given the time frame that we have chosen. Then we look at issue prioritization. This is actually where we make the distinction between two types of factors. One set of factors will be those that can take different values over time, but at the same time that are very important given the central question at hand. And these factors, we call them critical uncertainties. Other factors pertain to what some people call predetermined elements, yet others call them givens, and yet others call them megatrends. The last term is actually an interesting one, because if we look at it, the word says it all. Mega means important, trend. It's actually something that's quite predictable. An important, quite predictable factor or set of factors. And then these two set of factors we then use in order to develop the logics of the scenarios, and very often we use system thinking maps. These kind of scenarios, at least sketch scenarios, one can easily develop within half a day. And in educational settings and also within workshops, we very often do that. For an organization, typically to do that in more detail, it takes more time. But in an educational setting, in order for people to understand how it all works, in half a day one can come up with good scenario logics. The difference with step five, scenarios and scenario logics, is the translation of the logics into narratives. And the narrative, the power of the word, very often told as a story, need to be very appealing. The area on the right of your screen, I'm not going to focus on right now. I will come back to that later on. But that area has to do with option generation, but also with strategic early warning. You may have heard about peripheral vision, a good friend of mine, Paul Schumacher from Wharton and DSI, Decision Strategies International. He actually wrote a book called Peripheral Vision, and this is all about scanning the periphery for weak signals. But more on that in about 10 minutes. Let's now have a look at strategy, because we need to look at strategy within the context of an uncertain world. So scenarios are a means to an end. I mentioned that before, and they can be used for stakeholder debate. For example, a company could actually engage civil society or policymakers or customers in order to engage in stakeholder debate. It's actually, from that point of view, a very powerful tool. But also companies, and initially scenarios were designed not for stakeholder debate, but in order to generate strategic options. But what I increasingly see with the companies I work with, both in executive education and in consulting, is that more and more companies are using it for both purposes, both to generate strategic options and to engage stakeholders in a powerful learning experience. And as a result, resolve differences or arrive at a consensus, which is obviously very important. Before, we looked at the definition of scenarios, and that definition had one particular characteristic, and that meant, or that was, divergent. And given the divergent nature of the scenarios, one cannot have all the strategic options that have to be robust against all scenarios. If your portfolio as a company executive would be robust against two very divergent worlds, your entire portfolio, then you will probably not be very well prepared in order to compete in the future. Robust strategy is very much about current competitive advantage and very risk averse. That doesn't mean that I suggest that you would become less risk averse. But there are ways to think about linking scenario planning to decision making that allows you not necessarily to take more risk. And I want to present to you first, very quickly, two scenarios. You will get the transcript of these slides, and I won't go over it in too much detail. But I want to present to you, based on the images, have a look at the images. And the images actually say a lot about what these two scenarios are. Let me start with the protectionist scenario, which is the one on the right-hand side with the circles around certain geographic regions. These are global scenarios that we developed over the course of a year. They have been finalized towards the middle of this year. And 200 people from about 50 countries have been involved in developing these scenarios. So we could really say that we had very divergent views in order to develop these. We were coming out of the global economic crisis. There were already signs that the Eurozone was getting towards a debt crisis, especially driven by Greece, but not just by Greece, by other countries, especially southern countries in the region, including the one where I work as a professor, Spain, at IE Business School. But the protectionist world is very much an environment where the focus is much more on preserving the status quo and not addressing the imbalances that currently exist, especially the economic imbalances. And as a result, this is the environment that where we see multiple standards emerging as opposed to global standards. We also see far less global trade. Economic growth is somewhat depressed, a little bit more volatile and more prone to cyclical recessions. And it's an environment in which actually the potential is not realized. And especially OECD countries suffer most in this environment. But that doesn't mean that it's only OECD countries. it's also an emerging market, because right now we still see very strong trade between emerging markets and OECD countries. So if OECD countries don't do that well, then also emerging markets will, at least in the short term, not reap the benefits. It will take time, if that scenario plays out, for them actually to see higher and less volatile economic growth. Not necessarily a great environment to start a career with in, or actually to be an entrepreneur in, or to pursue a growth strategy for your business, especially if it involves global trade and global business activity. The transformative world is fundamentally different. What the line shows is actually that it's a very interconnected world. But in order for that world to emerge, we need to fundamentally address the imbalances, especially the economic imbalances. And there, we don't have fundamental agreements, not necessarily alignments. Look just in Europe with the debt crisis. Even Britain is not fully aligned with the members of the Eurozone. I'm not pointing fingers here, but it's definitely not a world where we see actually a kind of environment altogether now. In the transformative world, we would see global standards. We would see people, goods, and capital flow much more freely. It's in essence a scenario, globalization at its best. That doesn't mean there's no volatility. Of course there's volatility, but it's an environment where we see much more resilience to shocks, and where actually problems are addressed proactively and by working together. Two different worlds. And let's have a look at strategy within a context of two different worlds like this. And to do that, I want to present you first with a framework. I'm going to talk about robust strategy, flexible strategy, and multiple coverage strategy. As mentioned before, it's very difficult to have strategic options, or your entire portfolio of strategic options in your company, that are robust against all scenarios. I'm not saying that not a part should be robust. It has to be. Otherwise, there is no current cash flow. And there need to be current cash flow. And that comes to a large extent from robust strategy. But the question is, where will future competitive advantage come from? And that will come from flexible strategy and multiple coverage strategy, given changing environments going forward. In essence, one can see flexible strategy as a portfolio of real options. Relatively small things or options that can be scaled up or abandoned later, depending on how factors play out. And multiple coverage strategy is actually where a company pursues two or more strategies in parallel, which also means it needs to put a much bigger stick in the ground in terms of resources allocated, both human and capital. And it also means that very often it's an industry that is at a fundamental transition. And some industries from time to time face fundamental transitions. Let me give for each of them within the two scenarios that I just described to you an example. Let's start with robust strategy. What you see here is the third generation Toyota Prius. If 12 years ago I would be talking about the first generation Toyota Prius, I would not classify it as robust strategy. But look at the current situation. And I'm looking actually at hybrid cars in the United States. It's actually the market where you see most hybrid cars, and Toyota, with the Prius, has the lion market share, by far the biggest market share. Toyota, in addition, has a very strong brand image, very good quality, and the reason why it's considered robust strategy, because whether it's a protectionist world where actually energy security is a more important factor, or a transformative world where sustainability, both economic and environmental sustainability, is important, the Prius will still sell, and as a result it will create for Toyota shareholder value. That doesn't mean that the Prius or electric hybrid cars, not fully electric, but hybrid cars, will continue to stay robust strategy for Toyota. Eventually Toyota will have to go to full electric cars, but they can probably go several further generations of hybrid cars and create value for the shareholder as a result. 12 years ago, when they started the experiment, it was considered flexible strategy. And the reason was they didn't know whether hybrid cars would be a success in the United States. But flexible strategy also meant there was an option. If they would see that the first generation Prius would not become a success, they would decide not to develop the second generation. That flexibility is definitely valuable in the face of uncertainty. And that brings us to the second type of strategy, which is flexible strategy. And here I'm taking an example of biofuels. I'm not at all trying to say that, one, the world is running out of oil, that's not the case, or that we won't be using hydrocarbons for a very long period of time. Actually, we will. We will probably, it will probably remain the dominant fuel for as long as I live. My children may see a very different energy mix, but at least for our generation, it's going to be primarily driven by hydrocarbons. But a company like Exxon needs to prepare its future. And in such a way, especially in the energy sector, that it's not actually betting its entire future on something that may only become a material income stream in a long period of time, let's say 20 to 30 years. Biofuels from algae has an enormous potential in the long term, but it will take time to materialize. In 2009, ExxonMobil, together with Synthetic Genomics, created a joint venture, $500 million. Some people may say this is a lot of money, but within the context of a company, given the size of the company, but also the capital intensity of the business, $500 million is actually not that large. It's significant, but it's not that large. If this would not eventually turn into something which is a material cash cow, it would not destroy ExxonMobil. Where does the flexibility come in? Well, if the technology develops sufficiently over time and the challenges remaining to it are significant, and they're more likely to develop fast in a transformative world, then ExxonMobil has the right but not the obligation to scale it up, or has the option to scale it up. In the case of protectionists, it could decide to abandon it or scale it up at a much later stage. That flexibility in the face of uncertainty coming from scenario planning, that must be valuable and could give ExxonMobil a significant competitive advantage. And that's what scenario planning is all about. And companies need to have some part of their portfolio in flexible strategy, because robust strategy is about preserving current competitive advantage. Flexible strategy is about creating the options in order to have the right to compete in the future. A variation thereof is actually multiple coverage strategy. Now, multiple coverage strategy does not necessarily need to be part of the portfolio of a company. Multiple coverage strategy is typically done when an industry is at a fundamental transition. There may be some disagreement about this, but especially Carlos Ghosn, the CEO of Renault-Nissan, believes that the automotive sector is at a fundamental transition. It will take time for this transition to play out. That means that full electric cars will not be 20 or even 30% of the vehicle fleet in 10 or even 20 years from now. It will take much longer. But what Renault-Nissan believes is that they can launch a full line car of electric cars and make profit of it, create shareholder value of it, even in the short term. But in order to do so, it needs to invest significant amounts of money. It's not just going to be about creating a little option. To bring a full line of electric cars on the market requires a significant amount of money, and as a result we talk about multiple coverage strategy. That even in a protectionist environment it would provide enough cash flow to offset the investments. But in the case that the transformative world plays out and there will be much more demand for electric cars, especially from emerging markets, populous emerging markets like, for example, China, but also India, and even places in Africa, this could be a game changer. And in this case, a first mover advantage for as long as Renault-Nissan can create a competitive advantage period could really make them a winner in this business. There's a lot of strategy around fast follower, but I would argue that if you can create a competitive advantage period that is long enough, let's say 4, 5, 6 years before your next best competitor can actually do the same, in that case, you may want to go for a first mover advantage. And this is actually what Renault-Nissan is doing. And they're actually in their launch, which is being rolled out this year and next year, they actually are quite successful, especially in Europe with Renault, but also with the Nissan Leaf in the United States. But emerging markets will follow very quickly. So companies need to have a part of their portfolio's robust strategy, part of their portfolio of flexible strategy in order to prepare for the future, and when the sector or the industry is at a fundamental transition, and the question is then to anticipate this transition, is to actually develop multiple coverage strategy. Multiple coverage mean that, well, focusing on two fundamentally different lines of business. ICE-powered cars, in this case, versus full electric cars. 80% of the technologies in these two cars are different and require different criteria for success. So far, we have not spoken yet about, well, what triggers the decision to potentially scale up or abandon a strategic option. Well, it's important to monitor leading indicators. Not lagging indicators, but leading indicators or coincident indicators, really leading indicators. Let me give an example for what a leading indicator would be in the case of, let's say, the global financial economic crisis. Let's look at the U.S. economy. If we look at, is the U.S. economy in a recovery? Well, people would say, well, there is a slow recovery. But what would be a leading indicator in order to illustrate that actually the economy is in a recovery? It's not employment, because employment is typically a lagging indicator. It needs to be something that actually drives economic growth and as a result, employment. And that is actually investment by private enterprise. Not investment by government spending, but investment by private enterprise. Because it's private enterprise that actually sees, in a country like the United States, opportunities for economic growth and shareholder value creation. And when that confidence comes back, actually, that's a leading indicator that actually things are getting better. Not looking at employment, because then we're monitoring factors after the fact. And let me finish with an interesting example that was told to me in person by Pierre Wack. Pierre Wack was the father of scenario planning in Shell. He died in 1998. He was a remarkable person, a Frenchman by origin. And he spent many years, many years over time in India, but he went very often back to India. And this is a story he told me. And it shows the importance of looking at the system as a whole. Imagine that there is a farmer standing by the river Ganges, 1,000 kilometers downstream. Obviously, a farmer is going to live very close to the river, because the farmer needs the water from in order to grow crops on the land, but also in order to provide cattle of water. Well, from time to time, the Ganges River overflows its banks, and when that happens, it has devastating effects. People lose their lives, cattle drown, and harvests get destroyed. And for the farmer standing by the river, this is seen as an unpredictable event. But in fact, it isn't. Because if we look at the system as a whole and we look at cause and effect, then we can actually anticipate with a very high degree of certainty the scale, but also the timing of the impact of the Ganges River overflowing its banks. And that is driven by several days of heavy rain in the Himalaya mountains. The rain has to come down and actually arrive in the Ganges River, and then somewhere later, given the large amount of rainfall, it has to overflow the bank. Well, scenario planning and strategic early warning is in essence, it's all about understanding cause and effect. In this particular case, I only talk about one cause and one effect. In scenario planning, we have multiple causes and multiple effects. But really understanding what is the cause, what is the effect, and the relationships allows us to be prepared, allows us to anticipate discontinuities, and as a result, we can prepare our company or our personal lives in order to absorb the shocks in a much more effective way. With that, I would like to thank you for listening. I'm of course open to questions and answers, but keep one thing in mind. The trend is a trend until it bends, and it's very important to continuously look out for discontinuities, not in order to make us nervous, but in order to prepare ourselves in order to weather the storm. And when you can weather a storm, you can actually take the benefits of it. And that is, in essence, the most powerful message of thinking about scenario planning and decision making. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Alexander. Folks, we are open to questions. If you see there is an icon of hand which you can raise, and click on it, and I'll be
happy to give you an opportunity to talk to Dr. Alexander. So feel free to raise your hands. Okay. Rakesh, can you hear us?
Yeah. Rakesh,
could you please
yes,
tell
I can
where you're from and please feel free to ask the question.
Yeah, I'm Dr. Rakesh from, I'm currently working in Sohar University in Oman. I'm associate professor there, teaching in the area of management. First of all, I would like to thank Dr. Alexander for such a vigorous presentation. Really, it was a very well explained presentation. Just I would like to, for my own personal benefits and for more understanding, I would like to raise some question. Hope Professor Alexander is listening to me.
Oh, definitely, yes, indeed, I'm listening.
Okay, Professor Alexander. This is, when we look at a scenario planning, really it's a good approach and it can help strategists and organizations taking better decisions. But I would like to know about the time and costs of involving into these activities. Keeping in view the environment is very dynamic, and if organizations cannot maintain a proactive approach, means if they lose pace, then how it will be beneficial for them? One part, and second part is there's something like we call expected value of.
Hello.
Hello, Rakesh. Can you?
I heard the first part, but now I'm not hearing.
Apparently, Rakesh.
I hear you, Ali.
Yeah, Rakesh, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Okay, Rakesh. Okay. Could you please repeat it? I think we heard the first part, but somehow it got discontinued.
Should I speak the second part?
Yeah.
Yes,
or
please.
The first.
The second part.
Second part, first part was in brief. First part was regarding the time and cost, and I say that since it's a proactive approach and the and the environment is very dynamic, how to maintain pace so that we end up building scenarios and such things before that time comes to implement. And second part was the expected value of perfect information, which we use generally in operational research and decision making under uncertainty conditions. So how how much investment should organization make in order to get into the scenario planning sort of thing, since how much cost, because otherwise it will not be an advantageous approach. Thank you.
Thank you first for your comments and also your questions. These are very pertinent questions. First of all, I don't think that necessarily all companies in all industries need to develop scenarios. The companies in the following industries, in my view, that need to develop scenarios need to have a certain number of characteristics. Number one is they need to be a high degree of capital intensity. High-tech, pharmaceuticals, biotech, oil and gas, automotive are typically sectors with a high degree of capital intensity. That's, for me, a key requirement. Another key requirement, and potentially even more important than the first one, is irreversibility of investments. If you have a sector where basically you have inflexible, irreversible investments, then it is very important in order to think about scenario planning. Now, companies that do use scenario planning don't redo their scenarios every year. And the reason why they don't do it every year is, first of all, there's no need. And I'll come back to something which I call the rule of sevens. I'll come back to that in a minute. But secondly is the size of the effort. When Shell, for example, or at the World Economic Forum, we developed scenarios, we took an entire year. The reason why Shell takes an entire year is because they want to have many people involved, in and not only internal people, but also external people. The reason why it took a year at the World Economic Forum, well, the World Economic Forum, in essence, is a place where actually people from business, government, civil society, and from all over the world participate. So as a result, we wanted to give them a seat at the table as well, so that actually they could help shape the scenarios too. But I've been involved in developing scenarios with a small group of people in a relatively short period of time. And as a result, it doesn't have to be costly. And that doesn't mean that these scenarios are less well developed. But it really depends on what the objective is of the scenarios. If you want to engage stakeholders, obviously it's going to take more time and it's going to be more costly. If you want to do it purely for the basis of strategy development, it doesn't have to be very expensive and it doesn't have to take a lot of time. We can start with developing sketch scenarios that we could do in a 3-day workshop. And these scenarios, 80-20 rule, will be solid scenarios. But of course, we need to refine them further and so on. But you can do something very solid in a short period of time. The other part of your first question, it has to do with, well, how often do we do this? Let's say that you work with a company, and because you're a professor as well, you mentioned, and how often should that company repeat the exercise? Well, there is a rule of thumb, and that doesn't mean that there are no deviations from that rule of thumb, and that's the rule of sevens. Let's say that your scenario horizon is 20 years. Well, you take your horizon, 20 years, you divide it by 7, which is about 3, and then every 3 years, it is important to fundamentally revisit your scenarios. Not every year, but in this case, every 3 years. So if you look at Shell, for example, which develops its energy scenarios every 7 years, well, the rule of 7 applies because its energy scenarios are 50-year scenarios. 50 divided by 7, roughly 7 as well. So where does that rule of 7 come from? It's pure rule of thumb from experience, but not just from one company, from multiple companies. So it doesn't have to be a very expensive exercise, nor is it something that you need to repeat all the time. Looking at your second question, one of the powerful aspects of scenario planning, in my view, is options thinking. And the nice thing about options thinking is that it's the right but not the obligation to do something. And in essence, if there is the right but not the obligation in the face of uncertainty, then you actually like uncertainty. The more uncertainty, the more you can turn that into your benefit. And in order to actually quantify then that, it's important to use real option valuation for that purpose. The challenge with real option valuation that it requires, it's quite mathematical, that it requires an estimate of volatility. And that estimate of volatility is not always easy to calculate given that the underlying may not be traded. Company is traded, but your strategic option may not be traded. But it's possible to actually do that as well. During Palm in April, May, we will actually talk about that aspect as well, about, well, how do we actually value strategic options within the context of scenarios and arrive at an expected monetary value of it as well, knowing that these are still options, they're not necessarily strategy. I hope I answered your two questions with this.
Yeah, thank you, Professor Alexander. I wish I could have asked more and more, but I would like to open the floor for the remaining, people. So I would like to listen to their questions and answers. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rakesh. So I think There are a couple of questions posted in the chat box, but please feel free to raise your hand if you also want to talk to him one-to-one. Let me go through the chat box, question box. We have a question from, I think there was the first question from Muhammad Bilal. Muhammad Bilal wrote, interesting presentation. Just want to ask if you can briefly discuss scenario planning in the case of company looking forward towards different projects as compared to the one discussed by Dr. Alexander at macro level. Dr. Alexander.
Yes. Well, I could have presented scenarios at an industry level. But given that I didn't know who my audience exactly is, I said, well, let me just give high level but still divergent scenarios. Mm-hmm. Scenarios can be applied to any industry, to any country, to, in essence, maybe to even any issue. For example, if we, one of the things that Renault-Nissan must have looked at is basically the future of personal mobility. That could have been a central question. And explore that then in the same way as we would develop macro level scenarios. When we develop macro level scenarios, when we do the issue or affected identification, we will typically use a STEEP framework. And STEEP stands for social, technological, economic, environmental, political. The moment we look much more at industry or thematic scenario, obviously the factors that we're going to look at are going to be very different. But the process is actually no different. It's in essence, it is identical. But the central question, the time frame, and the factors that we need to look that will shape actually the context for that particular sector or company is going to be different.
Okay, thank you very much, Victor. I hope that first question that was asked. We have another one from Mr. Mubashir Rashid. He has written, we have seen the scenario planning in relation to strategy adoption, but how different would it be considering the tactical level? My main concern here is very short time and insufficient data points and measurement.
Well, scenario planning is typically not used at the tactical level. Scenario planning, well, it depends how we define tactical level. Scenario planning is used in order to generate strategic options and in order to monitor the environmental conditions to potentially scale up or abandon a particular option, but it's not used at the level for tactical planning. And I don't think it should be. I have never seen nor an application actually nor a journal or a magazine article actually written on it, how to link scenario planning to tactical planning. And I don't really see how immediately do that as well. It's really a tool in order to shape the strategic context of a company in which it operates, and in that context to identify strategic options and to create the preparedness of a company to make investment decisions or not.
Okay, thank you very much. We have another question in the question box from Mr. Hassan Al-Khayami, who has written, how we can define in which strategy we fall, what indicators we should follow to make an assessment to the whole operation in an enterprise in order to realize that if we are running in the right track or not.
Mm-hmm. The two important things, strategic options versus strategy. For me, strategy, the way I define strategy is concerned with allocating resources, both human and capital, in order to maximize shareholder value. So strategy, you have to allocate resources. strategic options, the resources are not yet allocated. Especially when we talk about flexible strategy. The reason being that, well, we don't know yet how the future will unfold. There are some factors that are outside of our control. There are factors that we can actually not predict with certainty. And then the question is, once we have a strategic option, what triggers investment? What needs to be true in order to trigger investment or abandonment? And this, of course, depends on the strategic option in question, on the industry in question. But once we know that, we know also what to monitor and what to look out for. Now, once actually, let's say the stars are aligned, it's very often the way I call this, once certain indicators provide sufficient confidence that actually the world is developing or the industry is developing in a certain direction, then actually allocation of resources, both human and capital, need to happen, and then it becomes strategy. So the key is to identify, given the strategic option, the right drivers, value drivers, and to monitor drivers within the context of the scenarios and make decisions based upon that. Which dramatically, in my view, reduces the risk given the divergence of scenarios, because it means that a company, in essence, apart from robust strategy, becomes a portfolio of real options. And it's very similar to a venture capital firm, which basically invests always small amounts of money, but in many options, and then some become a potential game changer, sometimes driven by technology, but also sometimes driven by exogenous factors. And the key is actually to make judgments about when to scale one up and when to say, let it go. It's never going to be something that is going to be a material product or product line, and as a result, a cash flow generator for my business. Ali?
Okay. Let me go over. My was a hand raised by Abdul Qadir earlier, so let me try to see. Mr. Abdul Qadir. Mr. Qadir, can you hear us? You had earlier raised your hand. Any other? We have another supplementary. Okay, from Brother Bilal, who asked again, is there benchmarking in case of devising a strategy for a company? Shall it be a flexible strategy or other option?
Could you repeat, Ali? Is there a benchmarking
in the case of devising a strategy for a company? Shall it be a flexible strategy or other options?
Mm-hmm. Well, the flexible strategy is not yet resource allocation, so which basically means these are still options, and as a result, they're for the future. If the entire portfolio of a company would be in flexible strategy, that basically means it would not have any current cash flows, and that would be a challenge. A company, and it really depends on the industry, but also on the stage of development of the company, needs to find the right balance between robust strategy, which is based on current productive assets, and flexible strategy, which is about future productive assets. As a rule of thumb, if we look at the oil and gas sector, for example, and especially look at the international oil majors, then I would say there is in the range of 50-60%, if not more, is in robust strategy. These are the types of projects actually that create a important return on capital employed. There need to be in the range of 20-30%, which are strategic options. And whenever the transition of the industry, and we could argue that actually the transition is already happening, but it will be a long and slow transition, that actually it needs also to invest a small amount into multiple coverage strategy, but it has to be a significant amount at the same time. That basically means we're talking about something like 5%. Now, the benchmark will really depend on the industry, the company, but also the relative stage that the industry is currently in. So obviously oil and gas, pharmaceuticals, or we look at automotive, are in different stages of economic maturity, and as a result, the way actually to allocate resources and to come up with these strategic options will differ, and the way that companies put a portfolio together as well.
Okay, great, thanks. I believe we have another, okay, Keshe's again on supplementary. Okay, do you have any supplementary questions? Hello?
Yeah, just if time permits. I am not sure how much time. Maybe you are running short.
We can. We have another.
Can I ask a quick question?
We have another 5 minutes, so please go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Professor Alexander. Again, you know, just a quick question is, like, when we follow robust strategy, aren't we taking a generalist sort of approach and compromising some specialist approach for strategy making?
A specialist versus a generalist approach? What do you mean? Could you clarify on this?
Like, if we take a robust strategy that fits overall, like it's a sort of a strategy, as I understood from your presentation, that it can fit in, you know, several scenarios, like two or three scenarios out of three, it will be suitable for two scenarios. So
yes.
This indicates that it will be a, some sort of general approach which will fit at two types of, you know, divergent situations. So
yes.
That means if it is a robust strategy, it has to be generalist by nature so that it can, you know, cover up in both the divergent situations.
Well, I'm not sure about the term generalist or specialist, but in essence, well, look at the Prius example, the third generation Prius, not the first or the second generation Prius that I gave. Well, whether we have in the United States an environment that is protectionist versus transformative at the global level, the return on capital employed in for the Prius will be in the range of 8-11%. So in one world it will be 8%, in the other one it will be 11%. So given the cost of capital of Toyota, this exceeds their cost of capital, and as a result it will create value under both scenarios, and that's why I called it robust. But also, these are the ones that generate cash flow today. This is not about future competitive advantage. This is something that actually Toyota can leverage right now because they have a competitive advantage in hybrid cars vis-a-vis their competition. Will they be able to maintain that over time? Well, for some time, yes, but eventually their competitive advantage will be eroded because others will enter that space, but also technology is evolving as well further on. And but flexible strategy is really concerned with, well, what are we going to do in the future? And we don't know that yet. So it's not necessarily specialist strategy, it's really, well, it's planting the seeds for the future.
Okay, let me frame it quickly in.
Yes.
Let me frame it quickly in some way. The context you explained it in the context of accounts, finance, and I got it very clearly. Okay. Now suppose I want to put it in context of say product development strategy. Suppose iPhone, iPod, and iPad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are three types of products.
Yeah.
You know, like if we say that iPhone is a sort of robust sort of approach.
100%.
Which takes care of iPad also and iPod also.
Correct.
You know, you can have both the options there, both the features there in iPhone. So
yes.
I just want to say that sometimes, you know, if someone wants a totally iPad sort of product, so their iPhone may not succeed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that means the specialist side. And iPhone, I look at it as a generalist strategy where it is serving the two divergent needs of music side and iPod side, and as well as the reading and these sides, web surfing side.
Well, but you see, strategy, if it doesn't translate into shareholder value creation, well, for me, it is not strategy. It has to be, right?
Okay.
You have to get more out than you actually put in. Right. And also you need to take into account your cost of capital. If you look at the iPad, for example, well, when the first generation iPad was brought onto the market, it was definitely not actually Apple was the first. Right. Secondly, was Mr. Steve Jobs and his team, were they sure that this was going to become a success? No, they were not sure.
No.
At that moment in time, it was a flexible strategy. It was clearly leveraging some of its existing technologies, but also there were new elements that were brought into the picture, including design and actually assuming that we're going to have a product somewhere between an iPhone and between a computer.
Hmm.
But I would now call the portfolio of products that you just mentioned, I would call them robust strategy. The question is, how long will these products remain robust strategy for a company like Apple? If you look at just mobile phones, who was the de facto leader 15 years ago? It was Nokia.
Nokia.
Yes. Where is Nokia today? Well, Nokia is not considered among the top leaders anymore. That doesn't mean that it's not a successful company anymore. But other companies like Samsung, HTC, and Apple have been able to innovate more and create, actually at the time, flexible strategy that has become robust strategy right now. And innovation, including product innovation, was an important aspect there too.
Yeah, I'm convinced.
All right, Rakesh, is a thing we're running out of time, so I have
thank
to
you, thank you, Professor.
I hope you're satisfied, so I'm going to meet
yeah,
you.
Yeah, thank you.
All right.
Thank
you.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you.
It's I love, you know, learning, you know, listening to an eminent scholar like Professor Alexander.
Indeed, it's been.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate the comment. But we need to apply it. You see, every situation is different, and that's important.
Yeah.
So apply it ideally for scenario planning and strategy. We apply it to the specific needs of the course participants. Much more powerful than basically listening just to me and having an in-depth discussion. I'm not saying there's no learning there, but the real learning is actually from applying it and looking at specific circumstances, which are different from company to company, from industry to industry, and from country to country.
Definitely, Professor. Thank you. Thank you for your explanation and time.
All right.
Most welcome.
All right, Doctor. I think you might have explained this one, which was posted again on the question box, but let me just quickly read it over. The question is for Bilal again, that what I have understood from the robust strategy, it always considers the existing portfolio assets available within the company as compared to the flexible one, wherein we may always consider several options with future assets based on the capital to be invested. Please confirm the understanding.
I agree with that. It's based on current technologies, on current markets, and it's also based on current competitive advantage spirit. And for as long as a company can leverage that competitive advantage spirit, it will remain robust strategy. But eventually that competitive advantage spirit will erode and will disappear. And then the company needs to have something else in place. And if not, well, then it could actually go down. Not necessarily mean bankrupt immediately, but it could actually go down. Let me give an important example. It actually happened to my family. You may have heard about jute. Jute is a kind of cloth that is used for packaging bags.
Yeah. Yes.
And at the time in Europe, it was used extensively. But then came, and actually it was creating for the business in my family actually important value. But then came a new technology on the market. And that new technology was extrusion technology. And extrusion technology made jute bags obsolete because suddenly a plastic bag became much more competitive, and overnight the business disappeared. It's anticipating these technological discontinuities that could fundamentally change the shape of an industry. And this is just one example, but it happens in many industries all the time. Sometimes it takes longer. In this particular one, it was a shock to the system, and it happened very abruptly, very quickly. But sometimes it takes longer.
Okay, great. I think we're really running out of time, but we have just one last question. So I think this is from Hassan Al-Khayami again. Let me see, Mr. Okay. Al-Khayami. Can you also speak up, or you want me to read your question? He's also posted, so let me read it for you. It said, what about cost efficiency strategy to leverage revenue with minimum resources? In which strategy of the three it falls?
Well, I would basically say it falls in all strategies. The people may have heard of something which is called Six Sigma. Six Sigma was actually pioneered by the Japanese with Kaizen and quality at the source. Right? Motorola then embedded it into its production. Six Sigma is in essence a quality control system. And then later GE took Six Sigma but linked it back to net profit. What does it mean? You can innovate and you can improve product performance by still using resources in a careful way. And I would say that's the case in robust strategy, but for different reasons than in flexible strategy. In robust strategy, it's in order to drive costs down and as a result increase margins. In flexible strategy, it is in order, well, not to spend too much because we don't know yet which ones will become cash cows in the future. But in all cases, I would say, well, be careful about how you spend money because it could be done in a more efficient way. So certain capital discipline and spending discipline is always a requirement in no matter what strategy you pursue. In the multiple coverage strategy, it's even more important because you could spend 5% of your annual investment budget or you could spend 15%. Well, 5 and 15 is obviously a significant difference and will translate directly to your bottom line, which is actually the cash flow and the total shareholder return you actually create for your shareholders. So it fits, in my view, in all strategies, but for different reasons.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, I think it's going to be non-stopping, so we have to end it up here, and we have been receiving a lot of comments, a lot of appreciations, excellent presentations. There's one which I would like to read. Somebody's asked if you could guide how can someone do a qualification in scenario planning?
Could you repeat the last thing, Ali? How
There was a comment question regarding, in case I want to do qualification in scenario planning, can you please guide?
Yes, okay. What I'll do, Ali, you have the contact details of this particular person. I will send you an email with information on that.
Okay.
And then you can forward it to, because there are a variety of options available on this front.
Okay. Well, it's been, everything is being logged, so we will, once I receive it, I will pass it on to them. I think that brings to the end of the webinar. Thank you very much, Dr. Alexander, for your time and willingness to share your information and experiences. Also, thanks to all of you who participated. We're glad you could join us and hope this session was helpful for you. I will be emailing you the link to a recorded version of this webinar in a couple of days once we'll upload it on our blog. I will also be distributing to you via email an online evaluation of this webinar, so please do get a chance to evaluate this session and suggest additional topics for which you would like us to participate in our online webinars. Your feedback is very valuable to us, so please do take 5 minutes of your time to complete the survey when it will be sent to you in your inbox. Also note our other high impact programs on high performance telecom and program for advanced leadership and management Palm 4 are currently accepting applicants for enrollment and selection, so please do visit our website and try to visit the details of the program and you could feel free to apply for it. Also note that on 26th December, Mr. Shahid Qazi, General Managing Partner of Value Strike Consulting, will be presenting a live webinar on an interesting topic called Back to Basics, the Global Financial Crisis, Root Causes and Remedies. Do visit our website again for more details about the programs and webinars. And once again, thank you very much, everyone, and enjoy the rest of your day. And have a good night, good evening, good afternoon, wherever you are. Thank you very much. Once again, thank you very much, Dr. Alexander.
Well, thank you for your questions, for having me on this webinar, and Ali for your impeccable facilitation of this webinar.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you indeed.
It's been great to have you. And I will be now...